Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
A little bit of a biology lesson on viruses, bacterias, another nasty stuff that can kill you, I suppose. And this is from having a discussion with a friend of mine called Pino. We just had a quick Skype experiment to get this up and running. And he said that he met someone in a butcher who said the next bug is going to be bacteria, and bacteria far more dangerous. So what I thought I would do is give a general biology lesson on what are cells and what are bacteria and what are viruses and various things. So let's start off where we should start off, with the beginning of life on Earth. So the initial life on Earth was a very hostile place, with lots of chemicals and acids and not much oxygen. And the very first cells to come on Earth are archaea. So these a cell is a basic unit of life. So a unit of life is something which can make a copy of itself. It can have basically kids. And this is one thing viruses can't do. They can infect, they can make more viruses, but they require a living host. So if you like, a archaea is basically, it's got the fundamental aspects of having a sac, which creates its own little nutrient-rich universe. And it has a little sac of liquid. And to make a little sac, it forms something called a double lipid layer. So even archaea have this outer surface, which is like, if you know, say you're cooking pasta or something like that, you add a drop of oil to water, you can see the little water, so the little oil floating in your pan. Now imagine you got into oil and you injected some water into the center of that oil droplet. You'd have a water droplet inside an oil droplet. Now there's the a cell has done a little bit more. What it's done is it's got this basic molecule which dissolves in water on one side, dissolves on the oil on the other, and what it's done is this is basically like a skin on the skin of your top of your cappuccino when you're boiling milk, that type of skin, that surface of skin. It forms a little bubble within a bubble. So this creates a little fish tank, a little environmental fish tank, and inside it's got primitive DNA, and all life is DNA based. And so this is why a virus, which has only got, in this case, RNA, is, you know, under several categories, doesn't have this. So this is the surface of your cell. And so if you've got, say, a water bomb, it's nice and squishy, and you feel that, and then you feel parts of yourself, your big Father Christmas belly and other things, that's nice and soft and squishy. Don't squish it too much, and don't let people see yourself touching yourself, because that's, you know, you explain, look, I'm listening to a podcast, they're not going to believe it. But you yourself are made up of these things. They're not made out of a care cell. That story comes a bit later on. So the archaea cell became quite sophisticated. So they had basically the surface of the earth available to them from 3.5 billion years ago to roughly a billion years ago. And there wasn't a lot of them, and if you were to land on Earth, you'd see nothing you'd recognize as life. There's no plants, not much photosynthesis going on. There's basically chemical eruptions from here and here, and possibly a little bit of rain. Oh, obviously, there's a lot of rain. There's very high mountains on Earth because the mountains on Earth have become soft and molded. And one of the things of the Earth actually being physically eaten by funguses and bacteria and plants is that it tends to break up the Earth and encourage erosion and certain type of stuff. So back then, the Earth is far more mountainous, a much more rugged place, and there's lots of ultraviolet radiation coming in, breaking up chemicals. Basically, there's lots of chemicals about. And these things, these life forms, are able to actually form little bags of these double lipid layers, and fill it with DNA. Now, the thing is that these were capable of amazing, amazing things. So they could live in very hot places. The Earth was a far more violent place. The majority, if you had to find the ideal living environment, there would be almost nowhere. The majority of the Earth was very hot and hostile. So these things are called extremophiles. They're still around us today, these archaea, that they can be dangerous, but they're found in hot vents at Yellowstone National Park, in vents, and inside things like cow guts. So the northern European animals have evolved to use these, and these like the extreme insides of your gut and digest your food and create methane. Now, of course, our kangaroos were not so tricky. Our kangaroos has very little of it. This is, Skippy. And they hop around, and that's when they fart. They don't fart a methane fart. So if you're looking at the impact of the planet, basically, if you can replace all your cattle with kangaroos, you will save the planet from global warming. That's just one little tip. So these extremophiles have come around. Now, there's a whole series of animals they're basically not animals, they're single-cell organisms which exist. One of the things I want to talk about is something called a slime mold. Now, the mold you see on your, you see in my house, where there's a bit of moisture and stuff like that, you see the black, that's the actual, the genitalia of the mold. The mold is, that you see, is basically a fungus type of stuff, and the fungus is a bit more sophisticated, but there's something we call a slime mold, which is technically not the same. It's not a fungus, it's actually one of these archaea cells, and these cells can grow into very large size, and they can actually, like the blob, they can move across the landscape and find food, and then they excrete toxic chemicals, dissolve the food and absorb it, and these can move in a large direction, and they can replicate, and they can go together. And when the food source is running out, they can, from these individuals, come back to a central individual, exchange genetic data, their genetics, basically have sex with themselves, and produce spores. Now, these are the hardened little spores for this slime mold to take on their next meal. So we live in this world where we think we've got cute little chipmunks and birds, but there's also these pretty alien things coming around. Further down the track, I'm going to talk about funguses and stuff like that, because they're pretty amazing stuff. So these molds, they're things, they are bugs, and they can kill you. There's certain version of these slimy things, I think they can get in your gut, because that's where they like to live and cause some problems. So this is, a lot of these things can get into the water supply, and you have to worry about them. So we've got the planet Earth 3.5 billion years to a billion years ago, and at some stage a new form of super life comes across. So these have got a big sort of like a big waterbed going around the place, and coming along are these basically bullet sized things called bacteria. And these are very, very small, and they have a sort of a sugary coating, sugar in your sugar cube, but the sugar coating has got each sugar molecule's got a lactic acid and half a protein on it. It makes it very hard and so it's sort of not too far off the difference of an insect skin, the outside of a beetle. And so these are bacteria. So they've got, these are little armored cars, and they're really, really small. And rather than have their DNA going all around the place, and not the DNA which we have, which are those big X's, they've got them in little rings. And so they're very sophisticated with their DNA, but it's still basically a tube. They've got themselves into a small little tablet. So if you can imagine a cell the size of a backyard swimming pool, bacteria is the size of a leaf landing on it, but it's in its own little pill, and the actual pill can, it's, you know, like a pill, you can imagine a pill of a certain size, and if you don't watch it, it will, after about sometimes as short as 20 minutes, you can stop what it's doing, stop, you can imagine that pill jumping around and doing it, and it will stop, and it will just grow, extend and double size, click, and it'll be suddenly two. Of course, two goes across. So bacteria are really good in that, in terms that they have developed ways of getting around places. And there, if you'd like, the Roman army or the German army doing blitzkrieg and things. So they've worked out that there's other friends about the place, so that they know about that. So they can actually have a form of not male-female sex, but a tube goes across between the two, and they exchange information, DNA information, fluid goes across, and they can go as an army, and they can, like an army with a bugler, they can say, right, the first time is going to grow, and now kill, and they will emit a toxin, and so they have these strategies, and they have basic warfare inside of them, so they can actually destroy themselves. They've got a piece of shit, and they want to, two sides want to grow, so one bacteria army, the bacteria will swim into each other, they'll swim to the thing, so they're a bit like all little miniature sperm. I'm going to gross yourself out about this, but these bacteria can grow so long, and they can actually detect their friends, and they can say, look, I'm under attack, and so they all group together, and at one hit, they commit suicide, releasing toxin out. It's not too, so they're not an individual. They can act as a team, as a society, as a almost as kamikazes, doing things. This is the tiny bacteria. So if you can imagine the cells, but we still haven't got into the fact that the bacteria were around for a long time, and archaea, who are the big monsters around the place, began to now archaea don't like oxygen. And very few like oxygen. Now, these used to come around, and these bacteria began to multiply a lot. The bacteria formed a cooperative colony, and that is a... they used to form a corporation because there's a type of bacteria which can photosynthesize. It's not a plant. It's called a cyanobacteria because they were the color of cyan and green. That's why they're called cyanobacteria. And this is what makes the sea green. The green, the sea is not green with algae. It's green with these bacteria, these tiny bacteria. Now these bacteria can form a colony. Now, I'm not quite sure what these stromatolite colonies were. I think they were funguses to exhibit. They're an algae and a cyanobacteria colonies, these big colonies. I can't remember what they are. I'm going to have to go back and look at it. This, of course, is an off-the-cuff, off-the-top-of-my-head tutorial. Apologise, as you know, it's quite windy outside, so I apologise if there's wind in the way doing him. So these little things have mastered photosynthesis, and so they live around the earth, and what they start to do is they start to use a sugar carbon dioxide process and start to harvest the oxygen. So oxygen is just oxygen is sort of for these archaea, sort of like chlorine or Dettol that destroy it. Dettol is a pretty amazing substance in that it's got a beautiful little chemical which just unzips the shells of bacteria. So there's no bacteria which has become can become resistant to Dettol simply because Dettol is a chemical which dissolves the shells of bacteria. So I don't know, it's got to be a totally new life form to be free of Dettol. However, these bacteria, the cyanobacteria, are producing a food source, sugar, and as a waste product, they're producing oxygen. And the oxygen builds up in the atmosphere and begins to gas and kill the archaea. So the archaea basically suffocating as these tiny bacteria form and form together and so they form together. Now, algae aren't actually plants. A lot of algae are bacteria forms, and incredibly, these bacteria can stick together in long chains. They can form colonies of individuals. So an algal bloom can actually expand in size with each individual cell doubling and increasing along. I know that this happens there, but they all independently reproduce. But they can also signal to each other and swim. A clump of slime can swim, slime bacteria can swim across to light and stuff like that. Having things like that. Now, you can get this photosynthetic substances to go. I was just trying to think what the name is called. This is where my memory is coming off. I've forgotten. Euglena. These are basically bacteria with a flagellum. A flagellum is like a whip, you Italian, Latin whip, flail at the back of it, and it's got some photosynthesis, and so you can have green stuff, green plants, which swim to the position. Now, something happened is that it's sort of like the archaea began to envelop and eat the bacteria for lunch. And obviously, if you are a cell, you have a problem that if you are a bag of water and you rip it open to have a drink, say if you imagine you're in a big waterbed and you're a fish in a waterbed and there's some fish food outside yourself in the waterbed and you want to get to it, well, what you do is you get out your flick knife, you cut open your waterbed to get to your fish eye, and all the water goes out. So the cells have this problem of eating, and so these archaea used to envelop their bacteria prey. Now that bacteria prey became really hardy. They put a digestive layer on the outside so they could be eaten, and the idea perhaps would be that they'd be eaten, carried along somewhere by the bacteria, by the slime mold or the archaea, go to a new position, the thing would die, and that'd spread out. It's sort of the standard thing, but they began to be so successful inside cells that they stayed there forever. Now, an example of that is plants, and the green inside your plants have the little chlorophylls. Chlorophylls are the old bacteria, cyanobacteria. And inside your plant, if you look under a microscope, you can often see the chlorophyll swimming inside the plant. It can move around, it can swim to the light, or it can swim in circles in a basic pond around the light, the plant. And the plant has an inner structure, but it's a bit like a car tire. It's got a water bag inside it, which it pumps full of liquid, and it pours in waste products and stuff like that. Now, often you find that the plant now begins to produce toxins, bitter toxins. So often, if you were to get most leaves, that'd be hard to break down, and they'd have all this tannin, this basic poison. And also inside plants, they can, in their little swimming pool, they can grow a little sharp, sand-like glass dagger, multi-sided dagger. So when you eat it, if you're another cell and you're deciding I'm going to eat you by enveloping it, you kill it, but then that glass dagger then kills you from the inside. So that's all there. So you've got the archaea, which are learning to eat cells, and they eventually get the little bits and pieces of it. Now, in each cell of us, we have a captive ancient bacteria called a mitochondrion. Now, mitochondria are these beautiful little bacteria. You feed it sugar, and it outputs a cell energizer molecule. And a cell energizer molecule is adenosine triphosphate. So the triphosphate is basically like your charge on your mobile phone, those charge bars. You get three of them, you get three charges, and this goes down, loses a few, and gets down to one charge, to mono. The little battery things which go inside your cell, it's the fluid of the cell, and energizes all the molecules in your cells to actually make them come to life. So inside your cell, this is it's called a eukaryotic cell, are these structures which are all little ancient bacteria which have now formed a colony inside your modernized cell, and that's what you're made out of, your eukaryotic cell. So let's go back over it. You've got the archaic cell, you've got the newcomer bacteria, and then you've got the hybrid thing of an archaic cell which has absorbed bacteria. Now, you are made of yourself, but also your bacteria. So each time you reproduce, if time a cell has to reproduce, it has to do a double reproduction. It's got to reproduce itself, but it's also got to reproduce enough of its internal bacteria to produce oxygen. Okay, I'm going to have to stop here, and I'll stop here for a moment to see what's come along. Okay, back broadcasting again. We just had a delivery up here, and it's this unusual thing in terms of in general, it's a real instinct to greet people, but you've got to let them deliver the stuff, put them water out of the property before you can actually do it. And my wife said, was he wearing gloves when he came across? So it's going hard. So I think Australia, I think we've got 6,200 something or other people, 3,000 people covered, and about 100 people a day turning up. And of those 100 a day, that's including 70 or 60 come from overseas who are picked off and scanned off. So we've got a low outbreak, but things are getting pretty well. People at least around here are doing the right thing. Of course, the police are going around with their cameras, checking number. They don't check number plates. They've got the cameras on, and the computer checks the number plates as you go, as they go past. And basically, they know. I don't know. They obviously have an art of picking people up. And big stories, and there was a minister, an arts minister, who's had to resign because he was. Had technically done everything right, but was outside his exclusion zone, and so it's part of the government doing the right thing. But apart from that, it's really quiet here. And of course, we're back into the story now of the Johnny Come Lately cell. I think I can't remember. It's sort of roughly a billion years ago, after the eukaryotic. After snowball or Earth incident. So there's a series of things which meant that we had a runaway collapse of carbon dioxide. So the plants began to eat up things. We had volcanism, lack of volcanism, which pumped out carbon dioxide. The Earth basically froze as it became snow-capped. It cooled down even more, reflected sunlight. So we had snowball Earth, a few instances like that. That really put the brakes on the archaic cell, if you liked heat, and it meant that cells had to be smarter, and you had the eukaryotic cell come together. And these became to colonise, and they had the rather genius thing that basically only one set of cells had to reproduce, and the rest, in our case, a trillion cells of us. So we're a million, 1.7 million, million cells is you. That's a fair amount of things. There are more cells in you, Pino, than the rest of stars in the galaxy, which is pretty amazing type of type of number. But let's get into a Pinot cell, and we're going to start to talk on it. Before we get too far, around the age of, I suppose there's a certain amount of the archaea, cells would just absorb bacteria. I'm not too sure about viruses and how viruses come in archaea cells. Viruses in bacteria are a major problem, because if you've got a large surface area waterbed just lolling over across, and you can actually get these cells physically, not the volume of the waterbed, but the same size of waterbed, and they're really slimy to touch. A single cell is slimy to touch. They're actually big. You can actually see them. They're sometimes the size of a leaf. A single cell. I don't know how bacteria happens to be there. They'd be outside and they just go in, and there's not much police work going in these cells, and so they just take up the bacteria and the viruses, and the viruses would go inside. So virus is just a little bit of rogue DNA or RNA. We'll talk about those in a second, which are out in the environment, and these archaic cells will just pick them up. The bacteria are a bit more different in that they are so tiny that and they've got a hard outer shell, and they are peculiar eaters. They can navigate to a food source and then put digestive juices around it and have nutrients. So the bacteria has got no guts. The bacteria just sit in the area and they just produce chemicals which dissolve and kill everything about them to move about the place. Also, it's very hard, if you can imagine, to get an armoured, they're basically armoured cars, and so what the viruses had to do to improve things, they had to actually get a helicopter with an injection, and it goes up to the bacteria, inject the little legs of the virus, cling onto the bacteria. It's called a bacteriophage, and then it's got a little, if you like, those pine gap sort of multifaceted shape on the outside. It has its bacteria, its DNA, and it injects through the entire thing. It's sort of like this massive antibacterial stuff. So there's these things. Actually, it's like a needle, and it injects, it lands on each one, and it's got these feet. These feet have got these landing pods on them, proteins on the landing pods, and they will land onto the surface of the cell. So that's its lunch, sort of like going into lunch, and it goes in, injects, and the bacteria is like helpless, like an ant with a wasp injected. It makes more viruses, and actually eventually explodes with leaving these bacteriophage. So bacteria is very small, and these are sort of like little flies which land on top, inject their maggots inside bacteriophage. They're beautiful to watch, beautiful pieces of machinery. But this fundamental thing of having the virus, of this type of virus, is pretty much the same. It's got basically legs to stick and an injection mechanism of viruses. Now, viruses have the basic DNA, but let me talk to you a bit about the eukaryotic cells. Eukaryotic cells have inside them bacteria. That's right, that you, Pino, beautiful as you are, I'm just lying to the international audience there. I've become used to you, Pino. Each one of your cells has bacteria, you know, and the more energetic your more muscular you have to be, the more energy bacteria you have in it. So your skin cells may have one or two bacteria in it, energy bacteria called mitochondria. Your muscles may have hundreds, and your heart muscle, which has got to keep on going, it's a marathon for your heart muscle. It starts when you're born, and finishes when you're tired, and it never feels tired. It's got thousands of these mitochondria. So if you can imagine these little bags, the archaic cells, these are great because what happens is these archaic cells, these cells, your cells, eukaryotic cells, have to absorb oxygen and sugar, and then it feeds it to the energy cells, the energy bacteria. The energy bacteria produces your cell energy juices, your lucky Gatorade cycles, and it basically expels carbon dioxide. So your individual eukaryotic cells respirate. Now, I just want to put in a little bit of a side on funguses. Now, funguses have this beautiful thing that they have evolved to eukaryotic cells, but then they have used the machinery of bacteria to use the bacteria walling for themselves, and they have produced something very similar to bacteria outer shell, and it's the same shell used in insects. And what they form is the fungus is basically it's not a plant, it's not an animal, but it is a cell, and it's a eukaryotic cell. So it's got inside, it's got even smaller, it's got bacteria inside it, but its life form is basically a rapier, an ever-extending rapier. And what it does is that these rapiers start to grow longer and longer, sharper and stronger, and due to scaling laws, they're incredibly strong and incredibly sharp, and they can exert tons of per square centimeter of force in front of you. So these could easily pierce armor, but they're really small and they don't pierce metal, they pierce cells. And essentially what they do is they go through and skewer their way through living organisms, and this long rapier comes out. And this is a very fine Marcia cells, these very fine long rapiers, and they go along and they skewer everything, can move and secure. And so if you look basically, if you get a big piece of racehorse poo, and a beautiful yum Italian beautiful mushroom growing on top of it, that mushroom, you rip it off, it's the dick or the reproductive organ of these tiny rapiers. And of course if you get a fungus infection, it's quite good because your fungus gets rid of your immune system, and it goes, and your fungus, these little rapiers go through, giving you athlete's foot or thrush and things like that. So these require things. So this is also in your the mold in your duco or something like that. This little looks a bit of dark mold. This rapier stuff will go through and destroy your duco. It goes in, it gets soil, and it goes into where there's moisture. It's got to eat. It's basically eating your house. There's dry rot, this fungus going into wet rot. Essentially, it's not photosynthesis. It's sort of the same thing as animals. Basically, you eat. I'm going to eat my beautiful pizza, my pasta. I'm just trying to make it lasagna. Yum yum yum. Basically, you're eating it and you're decomposing it. Essentially, when you poo it out, it's decomposed. Basically, funguses basically have the guts on the outside, and they go through and decompose everything. Pretty well everything on in your environment is a fungus, and a lot of the funguses produce nutrients and nodules. A lot of the funguses contain bacteria, which it's a huge trading system. And so if you see a tree at the top, underneath the tree is all this ecosystem of funguses and bacteria, and essentially the bacteria have got the fundamental, really important job. They've got something called it's sort of like a molecular nutcracker. And what they do with this molecular nutcracker is they break open the nitrogen. Nitrogen gas is like helium or argon gas. It's pretty inert. However, they can... there's this bacteria which gets feeded with sugar, and they go, and use this nutcracker. It's called FeMoCo. It's a cobalt thing. It's a beautiful nutcracking thing. It's a beautiful molecule to look at. And it cuts it up, and your bacteria produces your fertilizer or the nitrates. The nitrates are what you need to make proteins to make these more advanced cells. So it's this real complexity, sort of like the Lion King, the circle of life, but with a lot more science put into it. And so so that's back the bacteria. Produces a lot of vital things. It produces the energy centers for your cell, it produces the photosynthesis, it produces inside these bacteria nodules in plants, it fixates nitrogen, i.e. it manufactures fertilizer. Now, the modern world thinks, since the Germans were mucking around to build all their explosives for World War I, there's a fair amount of explosives, one could believe, happening there. They had the Haber process, and this Haber process, I think, takes 4% of the world's energy to make fertilizer. So we've got bacteria, and now we've got industrialized bacteria, which is out there converting the nitrogen in our atmosphere plus the water to make fertilizer. So a lot of the petrochemicals, all of the energy plants on Earth are making fertilizer. And in fact, most of what you eat, consume, does not come from the ecosystem anymore. It's now completely man-made. Yes, you may eat the beautiful grapes and the beautiful pasta and pigs, I suppose. I don't know what the prosciutto, I can't pronounce all the Italian stuff. You may eat it, but and that might be natural, but those things are not necessarily eating cereals and food which hasn't had a whole lot of fertilizer put into them. The fertilizer has a whole lot of nitrogen. The nitrogen makes up the protein. The protein is the actual machinery inside the cell. So the cell has a lot of water, a little fat layer on it, but the actual mechanics of the cell are these proteins, and these proteins are these little nanorobots. These nanorobots spring to life inside you, walking around the place. They actually physically walk around the open shut doors, that nitrogen there to make up this basic string of nitrogen. There's lots of nitrogenous bases in your DNA. All that type of stuff requires cracked nitrogen, and so it's all thanks to the bacteria. Now, inside your cell, there is the nucleus of your cell, which is a small little sphere. Inside the sphere is your DNA. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen these little things where they're really small and you put a drop of water on and they expand to something really big. But DNA is like that. DNA is this crystal, and it's held in this little this little holding pod of little vase, it's a circular vase, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. It's a circular vase, like a ball, like a light bulb, and inside it you put your DNA, and inside that you've added water, and what's happened is that it expands and it wants to explode, and so basically you've got this bomb inside every cell of the of your DNA, your nucleus. It's a little sphere, but inside your DNA it's a little bit more complicated, because if you can imagine a glass bowl, which is your DNA, and it's got these tiny little ports in it which the DNA can't spit out, but because it's water repulsive, all the DNA is like this. You can imagine, Pino, if you were given your chromosome, your DNA, it will be uh, 23 volumes of how to make a Pinot with a second version in case you fuck up and you destroy one. You can always have a backup version. So you basically doubled. There's a few exceptions in there. That's all there. And you can imagine, don't muck them up. I've got them all coiled up. Like cassettes, the old cassettes. Don't coil up. And then you go, all right. And what happens is you go in there, you hear that a kitten's gotten the control, and it's all the tapes are there, and it's all over the place. And if you were to open your nucleus at any point in time, besides when it's just ready to, we're going to divide up now, before that time, it's all splayed out, and this crinkled DNA on the inside. So you've got your nucleus there, and the DNA is absorbing water. It wants to expand. There's this pressure. This pressure is great because if it makes any little fragments, these little fragments want to escape. It's high pressure, and so these shoot out bits of DNA code. It's like an Italian restaurant. You go inside to your DNA. You say, "Hey, what do you want tonight?" So I'd like 3 pieces. Garlic bread and vino all around, and that gets written down, and it goes out to the kitchen. There is a kitchen inside each cell, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. What happens is that the kitchen is beautifully laid out. It's called the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which means rough because there's little cooking stations on it. But it's endoplasmic, means it's inside your cell plasmic. Reticulum means basically corridors and stuff like that. So this is a lovely tubular system. Hooked onto your nucleus, there's a little room inside your nucleus called the nucleole. And inside that nucleole, what they do is they go, okay, we need some chef stations. And so what happens? The DNA starts to make these orders, which could be interpreted as ordered, but they stick together. So you can imagine a pizza order for a pizza pie, for beautiful mozzarella and all that type of stuff, goes all together, and it gets pushed into this anteroom, and it gets stuck together, and oh my god, I'm a chef. It actually builds these little chefs, and these chefs go, let's walk out here. And they walk out here through this beautiful tubular place, and they go up to the surface, and there they are chefs, and they're waiting for orders, and they come along the outside, and they produce these beautiful proteins come together. But they're all sort of mucked together, and so what happens is that they come from here, and they're taken in plates. But then if you have something on a plate, they would just float around the cell. So it's these dome flat plates. Now, it's hard to believe. These dome plates are picked up by these little molecular robots, and they are little waiters, and they walk along these things, and they put this plate of what's asked into called the goggly apparatus. This is other part of the cell, which is also a tube thing, but it's for plating out presentation. It presents these things and pushes them out. Now this is where we have the virus. Your COVID virus comes along. That's it with any other virus. It's got these legs which go to the surface of the cell and go, Uber Eats, ding dong, invite me in. And it says, I've got something for you. And the cell goes, or press the passkey, and it presses the passkey, and the cell cell merges with the coating of the COVID and takes the material in. The COVID's a little bit smart. The COVID doesn't bother going into your DNA, but really good viruses go into your DNA. So you've got two types of virus. This is an RNA virus. A DNA virus has some DNA, and the DNA has some code in it. Says, "I've got to get into your nucleus." Now, of course, things always get into your nucleus. So, if you have a glass of milk, the milk goes in, and it It goes into your DNA of your palate, and the chemicals go in there, and it says, hey, you need some lactase, something to break up the lactic acid, not lactic acid, what's in there? There's a sugar in milk. Something or other. Lactose. This sugar. I need to break it up. And so what happens is it says, hey, I've got to make some stuff like that. And so the chemicals go in and then they interact with other things, and the orders are thing, and the DNA says, make some of these. And you faster than you can think of, you produce the chemicals to digest your lactic acid, your lactose. Lactic acid is a different thing. So it goes through there. Now, it turns out that part of the thing is your going in there and saying, mate, you're missing some of your DNA. Why don't you take on some mine? It's all okay. It goes in there and your DNA starts to produce it. And 10% of you, that's 10% of you, Pino, which is probably, say, from your knee down to your foot in terms of weight, but in terms of your DNA, is ancient viral DNA. This is viruses which have got in, wreaked havoc, and the body has eventually worked out how to stop it. But it's inside each of your million cells is the length, a piece of very fine, it's like a USB stick, you know, it's like a 3 gigabit USB stick inside each of your cells. And if you read it out, it's a meter, it's 1.8 meters long. So that's for you, Pino, if you put your hand up to the sky as fast as you can reach down to your toes, there's a strip of this very fine computer code inside each of your cell, all coiled up. And of course, this is coiled up really tightly into this tiny little thing, your nucleus, and in the nucleus is a little sub-bubble, and then that sub-bubble, we just go through, you put your RNA chefs, it's called, ribosome, a some means something which does something. These ribosomes actually make things. Now, what happens with the COVID is that it's covered with those little keys on the outside. Those keys are enough for the cells to say, mate, come on in. They come inside and say, what the heck are you doing? Now, it's a little bit more sophisticated what the RNA this thing is saying. Don't worry, mate, we're just making this innocuously really long, complicated protein. It's a really long protein, and go, oh gosh, that is just a real waste of space, mate. But what it does is it then says, and here at the end of these are these little choppers. The choppers go up and recut up that protein. So that long protein, which is really, what the heck is it? It's been cut up into little bits, and these little bits then come together to reform. It goes through a process and it actually eventually builds another copy of itself, and it builds up several of these. And what happens is the several things that can go to the surface of the cell and say, mate, nice visiting you, and they go out to infect other cells, or the cell itself can explode. Now, the problem is that when it does explode, it's great, and the process of a cell reporting that it's sick, it starts to produce fragments of everything, and basically your immune system can sniff these fragments. So it's sort of like, you know how you can go to someone who's been wearing an aftershave, or I can smell that perfume, you've been seeing someone else, or your wife saying, what's this blonde hair here? Oh, it's from my mate. Well, does your mate have meter long hair, you know, stuff like that? And is it permed or coloured? You know, it's this is given away. So this goes along. Now, what happens is that you've got the entire planet and yourself. And now you basically are given the task over and over throughout your life to beat every single bacteria, every single virus, every single fungus until it beats you. But you keep on playing. And what happens is that something has got millions of years of evolution and it decides now it's time to eat a pedo. However, inside you, you've got these laboratories which produce, they're dumb laboratories, incidentally, produce antibodies or things which can actually defeat the chemicals on the outside. So these are things which basically, you imagine if you had a saw or a file and you just had the most sticky molasses and you came out and this sticky molasses got on your equipment, you couldn't use any of it. So it's this type of stuff. It has to be produced inside your body. So in order to produce it inside your body, it's made in your lymph nodes. So your lymph nodes are this thing very few people know about them. So inside you is your circulation system, which is sort of like your things where the blood comes along, stuff like that. But you also have a sewage system, an entire sewage system inside you. These fine little tubes which go in and little thing, and they push shit around you. So if, you know, like say if you basically, oh bloody hell, I've stepped on something, and you get a bit of, say, rusty nail, a bit of shit in your foot, your body has to surround that. It often fills up with pus. It basically, you know, when you get a blister, that liquid inside your blister, you're not full of liquid. It's your lymph nodes, lymphatic liquid to go in and wash internally. So if you have a bit of dirt inside underneath your skin, the blister will go in and wash it through, and it'll wash it and it'll just stream it up. It'll stream it up to your lymph nodes, which are organs, and that crushes and destroys things. So you've got a whole system of cell. So your lymph nodes have to heat up. And when they heat it up, it's sort of like saying, all right, you know how you in general as a person are incredibly lazy? Your lymph nodes are sort of like, I don't know, what you imagine Singapore is like going on full on. So you can actually switch it on. What you do is you switch it on by actually raising your temperature. So the virus doesn't raise your temperature. It says, it's like the government not putting yourself in lockdown, saying, we're going to put all our resources in, stop what you're doing now, lie down flat. We're going to increase the temperature of your body so you're completely stuffed and stuffed. And we're going to do all the functions. And it's now time to, your body gets put into lockdown. And your lymph nodes are sort of like the CSIRO Defence Department all rolled in together. I don't want to just talk about Australian military because we are just so small. We're almost like the time you write down the Australian military, you've basically summarised it all. We're as strong as probably our pamphlet, which we've got as much defence as you can actually see on paper. We are an army on paper, basically. But I won't go into that too much. So you increase the temperature because what temperature goes is, once the temperature increases, it enables your lymphatic system to operate more quickly and evolve more quickly. And essentially, it's going out and saying, we don't know what's going on. Let's get everyone in all of Australia to write in their suggestions, and we're going to go through them one at a time and not all of them at the same time and suggest them. And so it's like this post office, this huge evolution goes on steroids. So the lymph nodes begin, as they heat up, they begin to produce material solutions. In a couple of days, they have 1,000 years of evolution going ahead. And each person who solves who recovers from COVID-19 has actually individually produced their own antibodies. They have actually, in themselves, have learnt how to do it. Now, there is this idea that people, if they catch COVID-19, they will lose immunity to it. They might, if the body loses, but you can become immune to something as a child and be immune to it when you're sick, when you're later on. So there's the antibodies. You've also got the white cells, and the white cells are something I think you'd rather like. So the antibodies, which go along, and they actually identify the thing, saying the antibodies stick to the virus, so the virus goes in, but they also can actually identify which cells have to be killed. So essentially, it's as if we go in and we had, it's awful to say, that the police had a gun with a silencer, and they do a COVID-19 test on you, and if you're a cell, they'd say, well, we'll deal with you, and go, poof, and that shoots you. And now what happens is that when this happens, you can imagine the police going around to everybody with a who had COVID-19, and they shot them. And when they shot them, it spread the virus all around the place, which is not necessarily sort of bad. The body's now worked out how it's going across, and then they just send in more police to shoot more people. But of course, if your body's on overdrive to detect and create antibodies, it will produce more. The army will step up and up, and it's about the sort of the restraints have been pulled back. And this shooting cells and getting them to explode means that every cell that explodes puts these pathogens into the body, and the body responds to more and more of them. And essentially it says, well, I can't take a risk. It could now be this or this or this. There's more armies out, and they start, and there's more cells going out and shooting them. But the white blood cell is the ninja cell of them all. They're great. So what happens is that they go, the white cells go around the, they're like the cops, and they don't have a search warrant. They go along, and each cell in your body, in fact, is connected to, plumbed to the blood supply. So each cell, no matter how, where it is, somehow it's got a capillary going past it. Now, the capillary goes up, and it can detect something. It's sort of, it's got its radar there, and it says, okay. It's sort of like out of Terminator 2 liquid metal technology. It can actually form into a liquid, and it can actually say if they're the cops and they're knocking on your door and they go, Pino, it's the police, and they say, and you go to the window and say, shut up, I'm not home, and the police then can actually go into a liquid and creep underneath the door. And that's what these cells do. These white cells can actually go around your body, and then they can just say, well, we're going to get there, and they can actually go in between cells and navigate wherever they want to the body and actually destroy it. Now, the destruction there is there. Now, these white cells can actually go into your tear ducts and walk around your face at night, knocking out bacteria, and then shit, he's going to wake up, and they walk back inside. So these are pretty amazing cells. You know, this is something which, you know, I find amazing to understand. And so you've got this complex thing going across. Now, the majority, I'll just talk on the virus cells. The virus cells only really have to get out, in most of the time, where they meant to survive is inside your body. It's nice and moist. There's lots of liquid around. Inside your body's got this beautiful fat. And so when you sneeze and cough out, I really wonder how this happens. And these cells are coming out. So they're doing battle. Yeah, they're emerging from the surface of your cell, going to the outside. Now, one of the interesting things is that in order to actually clean, your nose is producing a sticky mucus waterfall of shit, which means that most pathogens land in your snot. And your snot gets slowly down your gullet. You have your beautiful pheno and something like that. It goes into your gullet and gets digested in an acid bath. And so, in general, your snot is designed to catch pathogens. And essentially, when a huge full-on battle is going on, your lymph nodes, your white blood cells are doing absolute slaughter. And when it's a viral infection, you tend to have runny nodes. It's actually done rather neatly and well controlled, and essentially you have a runny nose. Your system's trying to flush it out, and so it's irritated, it's producing a clear runny nose. If it's snotty, it's having a good old fight. The bacteria producing bacteria, it's got to go out there and eat bacteria. And basically, the snot, a lot of the runniness of the snot is actually expanded DNA. It's sort of like your cell, if it's broken up and totally destroyed and it hasn't been able to get back. Normally, your snot and pus goes inside into your lymphatic system, but it's going on that side. So your green snot is more a bacterial infection coming out. Now, one of the things is that there's this elaborate process of where you get some salt, you get some detergent, and the salt, especially crystalline, hard crystalline salt, is enough to create a pressure inside your cell to actually blow open your nucleus. And when it blows open the nucleus, your DNA springs out. And your DNA has been wanting water, and it sucks the water in around it. But if you put some cold isopropanol or rubbing alcohol on top, your DNA can see that and it says, oh, that's, I actually prefer that, thank you very much. And the DNA Houdini's, sort of, it snakes itself up, and you get these little snakes of DNA up, and you can separate DNA up, so you can get any small amount of stuff, like really small, incredible stuff, and a small amount of nothing will produce a fairly big glob of DNA. It's because it's held under pressure. And the people then, you can then get your DNA with a toothpick or a thing, and you can twirl it up like spaghetti. And what you pick up, and students go, my God, it looks like snot, because it is, in actual fact, pretty much like snot. It's got the juiciness, the sort of heaviness of snot. You know how snot has got a bit of moisture in it? So that's real real DNA. Why it's green, I'm not quite sure. Sure to do with that. I have to have a think of that. So that's a bit of an example, giving you an example to what the virus is. Viruses are dead, and your COVID 19 does not have any DNA. It's only got RNA in it. The RNA goes in enough to produce its machinery. And it needs a lipid layer, which I think, and the proteins. A lot of that machinery is just hijacking the machinery of the cell itself. It's basically, it convinces the cell. It just says, you're at a restaurant, and you just take out the chef's order, and you say, here, I want you to add, would you add your bank account to it here? Would you add this here? Give me all your money and stuff like that. And you serve out, and you have two customers dutifully serve the all the material to hijack it. The next restaurant up the road, like it's there. So, in general, bacteria are a different thing. They're a colony system. So, bacteria, I'm just trying to think what it's be like a bacteria. I'm just trying to think, what cholera is. Things like cholera, polio. There's various things. Bacteria are not as hard to deal with. Bacteria, you have antibiotics, broad spectrum antibiotics, and you have superbugs, which are bacteria, which have evolved immunity to antibiotics. Now the problem is not so much hospitals, is that when you eat antibiotics, your kidneys are very good at getting rid of the antibiotics. Antibiotics are chemicals, and in general they're produced by funguses. So funguses have a problem in that they, you know, in your beautiful cheese, you have the cheese has got these veins in it where the actual funguses, Marcella, have, these are the little daggers, rapiers have gone through eating the fat, stuff like that, and it produces these flavours, these intense flavours. The funguses have had to work out how to beat bacteria. So the funguses have produced things which naturally interrupt bacteria, which is the antibiotics. So in general, bacteria are generally fecal stuff. You poo in your water, fecal colloid, and things like that. Hygienes to go across like that. This one's an airborne one, and I think you can get airborne bacteria, but it's airborne in terms of this bacteria goes out, and when you sneeze, you put these tiny little droplets into the air. These beautiful droplets, and these droplets evaporate eventually, and they evaporate and go onto surfaces. One of the interesting things is it's been known for a fair while that metallic and plastic surfaces store the bacteria more, because the bacteria are a little droplet of fat, so to speak. If it's on a wooden surface, the wooden surfaces tend to tend to dry out things a bit more, and it's essentially drying out. So I think you can actually, I think one thing I'd recommend, I don't know whether people would say this is probably worse, but you could clean a surface with a hairdryer. I think that would possibly, in my viewpoint, if a surface, it can last up to 72. Now, a cruise line is a different thing. I'd be interested into why it can last weeks inside a cruise liner. Those cabins must be incredibly moist and damp inside. It's hard to say. I was never very much attracted to it. But I just wonder whether if you, and the research hasn't been done on this, whether you could actually treat surfaces with ultraviolet light. I don't know necessarily whether ultraviolet light works brilliantly against bacteria. One thing that works against bacteria is shouting at it. Not quite shouting at it, but you can actually put an ultrasonic wave at a bacteria, and the pressure can destroy it. It wouldn't affect a virus as much, but I'd say heating up a surface, ultraviolet light, would do these various things. I don't know. I can sort of imagine ways to design masks to actually filter out a virus is a pretty amazing thing. So I used to work in clean rooms, and there's something called a HEPA filter, and it's, I don't know whether you could guarantee the virus goes in. One of the things is that you couldn't filter out a virus particle itself. So just to give you these filters that they have in clean rooms, they wouldn't actually start working until a couple of weeks, because the actual holes in the stuff had to fill up with dirt first. They had a dirty filter actually filtered better. But I just wonder whether how face masks work, and I suppose I have a sort of various queries, I suppose, myself as a scientist, whether you could have an electrified face mask, you know, not that electrocutes you, but had an electric field on it, so that any particle going into it would be would actually, fine particles would tend to stick to the electric field. You know, I don't know. That's some point. So there's lots of research, but one has to realise that any good ideas that we have will only be useful for the long term, for the next epidemic. At the moment, people are so hard at things. So just to give you a list of people who are personal, that I know of, there's the chief scientist of Australia, who's organising or trying to organise Australian companies to produce ventilators. And there's a little bit of things. These are the forced things. They pressurise in your lungs. The incredible important things is that the patients who are at risk on ventilators, who die on ventilators, are on them for a long time. And the death of ventilators comes from poor pressure control of the ventilators. If the pressure is too much, if they may be effective, they may get you breathing at high oxygen rate. But then there's a risk of the pressure destroying some of your lung structure, which lets the viruses in and decays something. So getting it there. So there's actually a policy there that if you can actually keep people, although it's a bit frightening, say at 85% oxygen level on a ventilator, is actually perhaps better than actually getting them up to the 100% percent oxygen level. So there's a lot of stuff there. There's also the actual material to incubate someone on. So there's that. There's a friend of mine who's the top general, three-star general in the Australian Army. And he's I knew him as a major going off to Rwanda and all these various things. So he's doing the military side of things. And I've got various daughters and relatives in supply, doing the supermarkets and the treasury and doing things like that. So there's a lot of people working on it. So the answer to your question, in short, is that this has been a long, long story. And there may be things that you do know. There is a bit of a story about biology going into this and what viruses are and things like that. So this is a long, long story for it. There's not much of a rhyme to it, but it does help to know the knowledge of stuff. Definitely, this is I think viruses are the main threat, and bacteria, I think we've got other ways of dealing with it or understanding what goes on. You've got sort of bacteria, it would be anthrax, would be the ultimate bacteria. There's this fundamental thing between the combination of low lethality, low symptomatic stuff where you can spread the viruses. There's a whole lot of functions. If the virus is extremely lethal, it will kill itself out and it will die out in the population and cause sufficient panic to self-isolate. People become sufficiently frightened from it and change their ways. This has actually been a sort of perfect virus, being of a low lethality, asymptomatic spread, requiring a higher level of understanding to respond to it. So if you basically have a society infected by people talking about fake news, trust me, as opposed to scientists and who spend a lot of time backing out scientists. When the scientists have something to say, there's that couple of weeks before the death toll comes in, they actually require the dead people to die for them to, and they say, now I see it, I couldn't have seen it coming. You can't see it coming because you don't understand the basic maths. So this is definitely them. I think dare it to say that you can actually say, if you plot the number of years to produce a virus, to produce a vaccine, it's actually contracting. And so we're perhaps at the last sweet time where it will be 18 months. In a decade's time, it may be less than 18 months, and there may be other much more populated, strained population to come through. But the idea of being able to sequence and produce potential candidates within hours of something coming through is there. And I don't think governments, again, will not have a massive stockpile. It will be so cheap nowadays to produce basically a face mask for every person on Earth. And it will be a story of how long these things can survive in storage. So a lot of these things have a natural decay in storage. So anything with polypropylene, nylons and things like that, in terms of the stitching only has a shelf life of 10 years. But I should imagine in years to come that if China doesn't do it, India will, where you can actually say, order a factory, a face mask factory, in its shipping containers, and you can actually just put down the entire supply chain. So although we limit manufacturing, I think manufacturing is going to change, and essentially, we will be able to basically 3D print a manufacturing face mask manufacturing, and we will have strategic things that are sort of similar to our strategic desalination plants. We say, well, what's the worst case scenario, and at what point do we have to actually build desalination plants? So we can now build desalination plants so quickly, expand capacity so quickly within a couple of years, that we can actually hold off until the drought process is coming on before we lose our nerve and do it. So I think in future, I don't think we'll have huge stockpiles of ventilators and face masks, but we will basically have a stockpiled computer program to 3D print a face mask factory. And essentially, it will be, if the shit happens, can I do it? And the great thing about 3D printing a face mask factory is that you can basically put a SpaceX competition to actually leave it to open tender and make it an open source thing. So that's where I see. I don't think any of our inventions at this point in time, I'm definitely keeping quiet, not giving out too many inventions, because I know our Aussie people are doing as best they can up to their capacity, and I don't think they want to listen to any other zany ideas. Okay, so this has gone through to you, Pino.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.